to Hotel Bar Sessions, the podcast where three philosophers sit down at the end of a long conference day to chop it up at the hotel bar, which, as we all know, is where the real philosophy happens.
Welcome back to another episode of Hotel Bar Sessions. I'm Rick Lee. As usual, I'm joined by co-hosts Lee Johnson and Jason Reed, and we have a special guest that you'll hear more about in a moment. Today, we are talking about immediacy. But before we do that, as usual, we all need something to drink, and I would like to know what you're ranting or raving about.
I'll go first. So I'm going to have a margarita. We did have a couple of days last week where it sort of started to feel like spring, so I'm trying to encourage it. Porch drinks. But I am ranting today, and I'm ranting about text messages in film and TV. I can't read them. I'm just going to be honest. It's either too fast or it's at a weird angle or the print is not big enough. It drives me crazy. And I do think that there are ways that they can make this easier. I think, for example, the BBC series Sherlock did a really good job of incorporating text messages into the film. But the easiest way to fix this is just put the text message in the subtitles. We've all got the subtitles on, right? There's no reason for us to not just have whatever is in the text message in the subtitles. So that's my rant.
And by the way, get off my lawn.
Yeah, right?
Jason, what about you?
I'm going to have a Diamond Island mojito from the newly opened Jerome's, a bar opened by one former student of mine here in Portland. And I am going to rave about the new Inquiry. They just did a great piece on the University of Austin's forbidden courses. If you haven't been following this, this is the strip mall university opened by the defenders of free speech. And it's just a read which is hilarious and horrifying at the same time. You know, we've all been making jokes about this thing, but they actually sent someone to take the course. And journalism is definitely undervalued, long-form journalism.
Yeah.
No one wants to pay for it, but everyone wants to share it. It's kind of a big problem.
Yeah.
So we have Anna Kornbluh joining us this week, which I'm very excited. So Anna, what are you having and what are you ranting or raving about?
This week I'm raving about The Sting. I love to recommend movies or books. I think it's great for people to have enthusiasms that they can share. And this movie, 1973, a crucial year, with Robert Redford and Paul Newman, is one of those films that really makes the labor of filmmaking a part of its structure and its plot. Mm. So in pulling off a long con, there's a whole lot of attention to mise-en-scène, casting, costumes, playing a role. They treat the con not just like the charismatic con man putting one over with a story, but the whole team doing concerted logistics to achieve something. I love teamwork. I love logistics movies. I love movies that are about collective effort.
And they are so dreamy the whole time.
They are.
Oh my God.
Nice. Rick, what about you? What are you drinking and what are you ranting or raving about?
Well, like Anna, I am also in Chicago, and the weather has turned eerily springtime. It's going to be 60 someday this week, which is odd. So I'm going to have a French 75. This week, I am raving about Cécile McLaurin-Selvan. I think that's how her name is pronounced. Although she was born in Miami, she has one French parent and one Haitian parent. She is just a really fantastic young jazz singer who has both a modern voice and also goes back to the classics. She's just really, really fantastic. This week, we're talking about immediacy. So, Jason, let me go directly to you.
If one want to do a what's hot and what's not list of contemporary cultural trends and possibilities, one could say that immediacy is hot and mediation is not. Immediacy is hot in popular culture as longstanding forms of representation, such as films and novels, give way to the immediacy of presentation, TikTok videos, and the hot takes of the moment on social media. But what is striking about this tendency towards immediacy is that it's not just about social media and kids these days. The turn to immediacy runs the gamut from high to low culture, from reality TV to the prevalence of memoir and fiction and such trends as autofiction and even auto theory. And this turn away from mediation towards immediacy could also be found in politics, not just the politics of the terminally online that address every issue with a new hashtag and profile pic, replacing organization with expression, but also in the supposed radical politics that seek to realize their goals without the mediation of a state, party, or union organization. All of which leads us to ask, why has immediacy become so hot? What are the historical and economic conditions of this turn towards immediacy, and what do they mean for us? Joining us to discuss this is Anna Kornbluh, author of Immediacy or the Style of Too Late Capitalism. So the natural place to begin is to get a sense of what we mean when we talk about immediacy as a general cultural style. What are some examples of this immediacy that we're talking about?
Thanks so much, Jason. Thank you guys for reading and thinking also. I really appreciate it. So if the general style, as you started to say, is this kind of pressure on or crushing of mediation, this negation of mediation or emptying it out, it has examples and manifestations on both the consumer side and the producer side, that we have a limitless thirst, it seems, appetite for encountering the real right here, right now, viscerally affecting stuff. And also that artisans, cultural producers, creative types have a drive to style their own representation as merely presentation, as authentic, as producing that encounter with the real stuff, and as emanative or manifestive. Mm-hmm. That would be the kind of general logic there. And then to just take some examples, that we can span the gamut from things like trends in gallery art, what we might think of as high art, towards what are called relational aesthetics or sometimes social practice, taking apart the work of art or excising the bounds of having a specific medium and trying to instead engender an experience. You know, so I'm not going to make a painting or a sculpture. I am going to stage an encounter in a gallery space or even use a gallery space to deliver a service like dentistry or, you know, make a meal, where the emphasis is on these kinds of irremediable, unreplicable, evanescent kinds of bodily intensities and experiences that don't lend themselves to the whole apparatus of representation, mediation, and medium. So that would be one example from the kind of high world. And, you know, to take examples from the low world, I'm trying to figure out in the book, is there not actually a surprising uniformity of original streaming content, right? Like, we all feel this crush of there's so much, this deluge, and it's all so different, and it can be all so tailored. But there is an incredibly palpable, markable, studyable tendency in a lot of original streaming content towards things like front-facing cinematography, where there's this constant direct address of the protagonist to the camera. And that seems to be the integration of the platform for streaming with the devices that we also communicate with our loved ones on, FaceTime and so on. The industry does call that device integration. So there's blurring of the lines between something like a one-on-one conversation and our relationship to a protagonist and their confessional mode in an original streaming show. And it doesn't have the kind of effect that that form of directive address might have had in an older media ecology or an older economy. You can think of just endless shows that do that, from early Netflix and Amazon original content stuff like Fleabag and House of Cards up through Abbott Elementary. Like, why this device everywhere right now? That would be getting at this pervasiveness of the style.
One of the things that occurred to me in reading your work is there is also a lack of mediation of style itself. Like, when I think about people on TikTok or Instagram presenting themselves as if they were authentic, what they're presenting is there's no style through which they are mediated. They are, in a sense, just there as they are, without purportedly anything coming between me, the viewer, and them. There does seem to be an incredible lack of style in these examples that you've been giving.
Yeah, style is really a fraught and vexed thing. Like, how do you know it? And when something is styling itself as being unstyled, can we even talk about it as a style? But I'm trying to put my finger on those paradoxes and using that word. And I definitely think that, for instance, there are formal conventions that we can find lots of successful TikTokers using, or lots of successful influencers who are giving us the no filter, right? There are often these kinds of declarations, like, this is the real me, or I'm not wearing any makeup, or there's no lighting here. Right. Stuff like that, right? So there's these kind of principles. That way, there is, again, the front-facing kind of dimension of it. There is an appeal to the connection that we can have across these platforms and across these devices, that I am just the uncut funk that is emanating from my unmade-up face, and that that's going to resonate with you. But there are formal grammars to those kinds of things. And indeed, there's a whole ideological structure to the claim that I have these infinite inner resources that just abundantly effulge out at you, and that you can just sort of vibe with me and be in my stream and be in my intensity. So the whole influencer discourse often has this, well, this is just my innate strength. This is just my charisma. This is just me, and you do you, right? Right. And I think that that is a logic that we can start to try to point out and start to try to identify and talk about.
I know this is not going to come as a surprise to my co-host, but I'm going to defend TikTok here a little bit because I do think that what you're describing is a style, a genre of TikTok content. And I think that there are a lot of styles on TikTok. There's the get ready with me, which is a lot like what you're talking about. But there's also these mini vignettes that people stage. There's doing whatever dance trend or whatever is hot at the moment. And I don't think that all of them exactly have the reliance on immediacy that you're describing. So I'm trying to speak on behalf of my low culture listeners out there to really get at what it is that you're objecting to. Is it just the fact that this content on streaming platforms in particular, like TikTok, Instagram, Facebook Reels, et cetera, that there is an overwhelming attention to exactly the genre that you're describing, the front facing, or what Rick called faux authentic, which is a weird thing to say, but, you know, faux authentic presentation that acts as if we're just in the same room and nothing is mediating this? I mean, is that what you're objecting to? Or do you think that this can be extended to all of the content on all of the platforms?
Okay, I really appreciate that question. So first of all, the book is not a study of TikTok. Like, I just want to make that clear. So
I mean, I would read that book, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, one is waiting for the cool study of TikTok. But one of the incredible ironies about this book is that I wrote it a long time ago. Academic publishing timelines take a long time. Peer review takes a while. Mm-hmm. Marketing takes a while. There were lots of paper supply chain delays. There were inexplicable delays that I still don't understand. The press has to manage its catalog and so on. So I have a few references to TikTok in the book, but it really is the case that the incredible explosion of it in usage was coming into being and clockable in the book, but not a thing that, like, the emergent genres of it or so on were things that I was really spending a lot of time analyzing, because I finished writing the book years ago. So just to be clear about that.
Yeah.
Now, as a secondary thing, I am not objecting to TikTok, and I'm not objecting even to this style so much as I'm trying to understand it. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a project that is before us of trying to make sense of the present, and that there is, to me, this really remarkable consistency across something like the prevalent modes of TikTok that we've just enumerated, the prevalent genres, with other kinds of high culture. I'm a very low culture person. I've written all of my books about mass cultural objects. Like, I am pro low culture. It's not that at all. There is something that feels to me palpable about a dominant way of according value to aesthetic or anti-aesthetic, you know, non-representation, and something about the rhyme across different media who are all invested in rejecting their medium specificity. And I'm trying to understand that. I'm trying to contextualize that. I'm trying to historicize that. I'm trying to offer something like a causal account of it. So it's an interpretive work of positing a category. And then there is a evaluative dimension to that, because I do think there is room still, even amid our terrible crisis-strewn landscape, for substantive, texturized, complicated representations that own their status as representations, that don't make claims to be unmediated, and that are doing the work of constructing shared meaning, shared experiences, shared images, shared narrative, shared stories, and that there's political value to that kind of work and aesthetic value to that kind of work. So the level of judgment, as it were, the level of objection is to especially the proponents of the style and prophets of the style who think that it's the only strategy appropriate to our crisogenic moment, because I actually just think that's really misguided aesthetically and politically. Yeah. But it's not a rejection of TikTok, and it's not to say that there aren't people who are using media apparatuses for interesting purposes.
Both here on the podcast and also in your book, you use the phrase immediacy crushes mediation. And I'm wondering, is that in fact the case, or does it hide it? You know, I'm a good Marxist. I think it's mediation all the way down. There's nothing that is not mediated. Even immediacy is mediated. I could see then that there would be problems, and I'd like to turn, I mean, not now, but eventually in this conversation, to some of the social and political problems that arise from it. But I'm wondering, is there a crushing of mediation or just a covering over?
I think that's a great question. And you led with, I'm a Marxist, so I think everything is mediated, right? I am a Marxist, so I think there are some causes when there are dominant formations. I think that if there's something discernible as a logic of the present or as a cultural style in our dominant monoculture or mass culture, that that has structural origination, that has contradictions in our relations of production that are being modulated there. So when I say crushing, I am thinking about the grind of our, you know, human hamster wheel culture that sets these premiums on instantaneity, same-day shipping, direct access, on-demand delivery, instantaneous fulfillment, and so on. Those are economic, logistical, macro kinds of forces that I think are crushing the workers who are doing that stuff and are creating this basis for the rejection of media. People are wanting to present as their avant-garde origination, that they're going to hide mediation or that they're going to empty it out. Like a lot of the high artists that I'm considering, whether they're fiction writers or theorists or performance artists or so on, they understand themselves to be doing something innovative and radical in their militant rejection of fictionality or their militant rejection of the structured artwork. I am trying to situate that voluntarism within a network of causes.
I think what you just did there is going to be helpful for our listeners. So I want to point it out and maybe give you an opportunity to say a little bit more about this. But you really did articulate the two different senses of immediacy. One sense, of course, is not mediated. But the other sense is right now, in a hurry.
Right. So conversationally, colloquially, we think of immediacy as speed or haste or fastness. And there is a temporality to what I'm trying to catalog. And that's definitely pertinent. But that hurry or that speed or that lack of a horizon and that consuming quality of the present, that seems to me to extend out for a variety of reasons into this general negation. There is this way that we think, oh, everything's an emergency, so we have no time. Poets saying, like, we can't write metaphors about climate crisis, or nobody should be making fictions anymore because the world is ending, or so on. These are earnest declarations, but they're taking their logic too much from the causes of the crisis. If our situation of, say, climate crisis is largely caused by this intensified circulatory economy that we were just starting to talk about in terms of the speed of exchange, the speed of movement of goods rather than even the expansion of production of goods. If that largely tracks with the acceleration of fossil fuel consumption in catastrophic ways, you can't borrow your strategy from those master's tools. You can't say, well, if industry is doing disintermediation and industry is speeding everything up, then my strategy against it is going to be to cut out all the representation or cut out all the mediation, because disintermediation is their term for that. Does that make a little bit more sense?
It does, but I almost never do this on the podcast, but I'm just going to say why.
Why?
If the speeding up of everything is causing this dismediation or disintermediation, I'm not quite sure what the term you is, then you can't respond to it with the same thing. Why not?
I think it fails the bar of strategy. It's a tactic. You can see where people get it. And again, it's often very earnestly adapted. But strategy requires a little bit of getting out of the immersive quality and the imminent conjuncture and trying to take some perspective on it, trying to make some meaning out of it, trying to think about where you want to go in the future and have goals and collate people and articulate them together and construct them together. And just because everything is shit doesn't mean that we don't have an obligation to try to make it less shitty. And we need shared meanings, shared representations, shared visions, shared jokes, and shared art, and so on. In order to do that, we can't just use the strategy of shearing and evacuation and emptying out and vitiation, because it will atomize us and it will leave us with no meaning.
If you were to ask me what this podcast is about, I would say it's about having a drink while having fun talking about serious things. But the drinks we have, and also the server space we use, cost us money. You can help keep this podcast independent and, perhaps more importantly, ad-free by signing up at patreon.com/hotelbarsessions. For less than the cost of a mild night of drinking per month, you'll be helping to defray many costs of our podcast, and you're saving us from having to start our own cult or MMA. If you'd prefer to make a one-time donation, or several of them, gosh, make it a daily donation. Just visit our website at hotelbarpodcast.com, and there you'll find links to support us through Venmo, PayPal, or Cash App. As always, we really appreciate your listening, and we really appreciate your helping us to keep pouring wisdom one conversation at a time.
Anna, your book has its epigraph from Hegel. Immediacy is essentially mediated. I'm interested in talking about some of the mediations of immediacy and the economic conditions that drive this demand to be present and in the moment and constantly producing. I'm sort of thinking about the way in which everyone who produces something, culturally speaking, artist, writer, comedian, etc., finds themselves not able to retreat into work and then emerge when a new work comes out, but to have some kind of constant active presence, right? You have to tweet to promote the book, and you have to tweet to promote the art, and you have to produce videos to produce the music. What drives this thing to be ever present rather than this more cyclical economy of you produce and then you fade into the background while working on something?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really nice description of this predicament for creative producers, the predicament for creative labors. What it means industrially that an author can't just write their book, but they have to promote. And they can't just get a book contract on the basis of their book, but they have to have gotten it on the basis of their social media following. That is not just a thing to be deplored about, like our demand for personality or making the job harder or so on. It is a thing that is about the industrial reorganization of the publishing industry, the industrial reorganization of public education, the industrial reorganization of journalism. So we have a winnowing of opportunities for average people to become creative or cultural producers or professionals. And we have a constant barrage of media expectations that make it seem like it's the fault of individuals that those opportunities have been narrowed. But this is what deindustrialization looks like. This is what the contraction of the macro economy looks like in the G7s. Industries are de-skilled, downsized, workers are expelled from them. There used to be a thing called publicist for presses. There may still be in some presses publicists, but it's really the author's job as a devolution of that professional opportunity for the publicist, who is now probably some like freelancer who themselves only got the job promoting for the press because they have a big Twitter following. These are economic conditions that we have to understand as about the shifting in the G7 economies after the 70s that have been profoundly exacerbated by by digital transformations and responses to financial crises in the 21st century. We're on a different side historically of those crises in, you know, 2020 cultural production than we are in 1980 cultural production. To go back also to Rick's observations earlier, or Lee's thoughts about TikTok, what is weird for us is that we have this deindustrialization that is then covered over with the charisma of the producer. So it's like things have been taken apart in the workplace, things have been taken apart in the arena of production, and then the individual charismatic emanator is going to just fill that void. And boy, is that hard work. It's so, so exhausting.
This seems to dovetail nicely with, let's say, more recent phase of capitalism that one might call the neoliberal phase. If one looks back at Marx's critique of an economist like Malthus or others of the time, you know, he says that they begin with population as something that seems to be concrete and immediate, but in fact, it's mediated through all sorts of things: gender, division of labor, class division, racial divisions, and so on. And here, I think with the neoliberal economy, we don't begin with population, but capital begins at home, as it were. Any capital that I could produce and amass starts with myself, now considered to be my own capital. I think one of the implications in industry and business is that we now all have to do everything. Even as academics, I think we see this. I have to now keep my own website, and I have to do an awful lot of scheduling and other things I didn't used to have to do. I have to put my own human capital to work in order to produce more capital. That, I think, puts a big pressure on this kind of immediacy and this charisma, as you were talking about, mm-hmm. that now I have to be the one generating all of this income. I have to be generating the huge following. I have to be generating all of this. And so this move that you're talking about, one of the forms in which it actually is mediated, so immediacy is mediated, is through this neoliberalization of the economy.
100%. I think that's very well said, and that's very, very true. And we're used to telling that story in terms of its effect on institutions and in terms of Melinda Cooper's concept of responsabilization, like almost moral forces, as Adam Kotko argues. And we're used to telling that story in terms of ideological formation that is driving the compression of state functioning or subordination of state functioning to market imperatives. Or even there's a moment where Frederick Jameson tells that story as the penetration of the logic of reification into even the unconscious. So if my capital begins at home, it begins with my infinite individual resource that is just supposed to manifest, that is just supposed to actualize itself. Right. I don't need early childcare programs. I don't need infant nutrition programs. I don't need maternity leave. I don't need, right? I'm going to be a toddler influencer, which there are those, you know? So we have the whole ideological matrix of neoliberalism as the management of human resources and as the decommissioning of social welfare structures for that management, the crisis of social reproduction.
Right.
And then what do we get as the aesthetic style atop that, or the pseudo-ethical justification for it, but a lot of discourse about self-actualization, about authenticity. Right. You know, hashtag manifest is a self-help trend. It's just really important context to try to think through.
And I was thinking about the famous Jean-François Lyotard line that postmodernism is an incredulity towards meta-narratives, the whole meta-narratives of progress and sort of fall out of favor. And it seems to me that part of what you're saying about the style of too late capitalism is its incredulity towards narrative as such. Narrative becomes itself suspect. And one of the things I thought was interesting in reading your book is the short circuit you perform, where you point out that all of these high literary type figures in their turn towards memoir or autofiction, they're sort of saying stuff about fiction that I sometimes hear when I teach a novel in classes, like, why should I read this? It's just something someone made up. It just seems fake to me. It's much more real to get someone to say what they're saying and not make up a story about it. What do we lose when we lose the mediation of forms, aesthetic forms, like novels, films, etc., in this push to replace them all with immediate self-expression. The text-to-video thing dropped, and the fantasy that comes with these things, like one day you're going to be able to sit down at your computer and write that you want to see a movie where Captain America and Indiana Jones team up to fight Nazis, and boom, that movie's going to manifest itself immediately, and you're going to get instant gratification. Although it's worth pointing out that every time people talk about this, they talk about it with acknowledged intellectual property figures. When everyone says that you can write your own movie, they always end up referencing characters. Like, you didn't come up with that character. When I hear those responses, I say to myself, well, you can do that, but it wouldn't be a movie. Uh-huh. In the same way that just saying what you've gone through, like these stories that, not stories, but these writings that depict everything that happened in your day, it's not a novel. It's something, but it's not a novel. It's a refusal of that mediation.
It's a really helpful distinction that you're making between rejection of meta-narrative or illegitimacy of metanarrative and illegitimacy of narrative. And I think that's precisely what's at stake. So what are the features of narrative that are being attacked? Something like temporal duration. We often find that a lot of these contemporary fictions, whether avant-gardist or popular, have a very compressed temporal horizon. So there's not a lot of transformation that's possible. They have a compression of plot, right? There's not a patterning of events. Maybe nothing happens. So there is a devolution then to the importance of character and of ethos. It comes out of balance. The novel is historically a form that can balance plot and setting and description and character. And here we have hypervalence of character or ethos and a devaluing of plot and temporal duration and transformation, hypervaluing of presence. It tends to often bring along with it the notion that it is illegitimate to represent a field of difference. Social heterogeneity is a principle of expansiveness of what we might call kind of literary realism or aesthetic realism in many, many modes. And if you don't have different geolocations, different contexts, different time periods, because you have a compressed time span for your plot or a non-plot, if you don't have different kinds of characters because you only have a first-person narrator who can only focalize on himself and who thinks that it's illegitimate to have characters because those are unknowable, emanative essences that have to manifest themselves in their own text, like in succession with yours, then you lose the fabric of common meaning. You lose the possibility of abstracting from experience. You lose the possibility of constructing knowledge and constructing woofs for commonality and sharedness. In fiction, if you only write in the first person, you lose much of what constitutes fictionality, which is this impossible point of view that none of us get to have in our everyday lives and our stupid little meat envelopes. The ability to evoke the collective, the ability to evoke ideology, the ability to evoke kind of unowned thought or thought that doesn't belong to any one person, all of those things are lost when we reject narrative in these ways. You might also say on the consumer side that what's lost is our engaging protractedly or intensely with things that are demanding. Narrative takes time to read. It requires contemplation. Dickens and Forster, they always suggest that fiction poses questions like, what's the connection between these two things, right? An author is interested in these different settings and these different kinds of people and putting them all together. What does this theme have to do with this set of metaphors, right? You have to do that work of integrating the connective tissue or sussing it out when you read. And that's different from a rapid uptake, non-narrative, personality, eminescent aesthetic that has very short sentences or doesn't even attain paragraphs, where there's just this scrolling capacity that is appealed to rather than the contemplative one.
You're pointing to something that Hegel points out in relation to this question of immediacy, and that is that what is immediate, or maybe what presents itself as immediate, doesn't present its own truth along with that. When something is just there as given, our ability, you use the term knowledge, our ability to come to have knowledge about it, to figure out how it happened, what it means, what it's about, what it's doing to us, what its possibilities are, we can't get any of that without mediation. This is something I learned from Hegel. You're pointing out an interesting feature when it then comes to aesthetics. You know, as Aristotle says, art is mimesis. One would think that this imitation is a falsification, but what he's arguing is, in fact, That's the only way that art can tell a truth that doesn't show itself on its face. And so in a sense, when we're only there with immediacy, we're running the risk of only being there with what is false. Because as Hegel says, even false appearances form a part of reality.
I think that's a really good point about mediation, that mediation tells the truth in the guise of a lie, as I think Lacan and Nietzsche and many others say, right, is that it discloses mediation to us. And if we have aesthetic forms that reject mediation or that insist that they are not mediated, we lose that disclosive property. We lose the ability to think about the multiplicity of levels or how representations are constructed, and they aren't all that is there, what their determinations are, what their mediations are. So it's something like the critical capacity of aesthetics that is being stamped out in the pursuit of this style that I'm really worried about.
I can see the criticism that the presentation of, we'll just pick artworks as immediate, can often be a kind of spoon feeding, like spoon feeding literally baby food to audiences who don't understand the theorization of it, the genre, the meta narrative, etc. I can understand that criticism. However, I do also think sometimes that criticism sells the audience members short. Some of these immediate forms of entertainment, art, narrative, whatever, what some of them do by presenting themselves as knowable, like sense certainty is knowable or something, present themselves actually as an opportunity for the audience to reflect on what genre is, what is the meta narrative here, et cetera, et cetera. I'm thinking in particular of Marina Abramović's performance piece, The Artist, where she sits in this gallery and just allows the audience, I guess, to sit down across the table from her and just stare into one another's faces. Now, on the one hand, that seems like the perfect representation of the kind of immediacy that you're talking about. But it seems to me to, in some ways, sell short the audience there to not recognize that, of course, in all that time waiting in line, in all of their observations of other people sitting in front of Abramović before they sit, in the moments that they're staring into her face, that there is a lot of working through what's going on here and the meaning of what's going on here and the way that we're all connected or forced to feel disconnected that is, in fact, not immediate at all. I mean, it seems to me that despite the fact that that is a performance piece that seems immediate, like here is the artist, just come sit in front of her and look in her face. Mm. What actually happens there is not that at all. And so I wonder if maybe we're underestimating people's capacity to understand how immediacy is always mediated.
I think that's incredibly well observed, and it points to this really interesting contradiction that has been there since the beginning of cultural studies and often accompanies Marxist cultural aesthetic interpretation, which is, okay, but you can't predict what people are going to do with the objects, right? So there are people who study what do consumers do with objects. There are methods in cultural studies. There are ethnographies of consumers. There are ways of according so much critical energy to book talk, for instance, or to fan fiction. There are maybe even some empirical political conclusions that people can draw from, like, oh, was this movie actually radical? What did people do who watched it and then went and made meeting with their friends and started clubs about it? Like, that's a whole domain of sociological inquiry of cultural studies. It is methodologically a different domain than that of the study of aesthetic form. It is methodologically a different domain than the study of the historical determination of the conditions of production for aesthetic form. And I don't think that either one or the other is more legitimate. I just think that there are possibilities for critical knowledge to be the drawing of conclusion about how a work was put together or what is going on within the form of a work or within its conditions of emergence, which are different from the inconclusive cultural studies model of, well, maybe 30 years from now, we can say that people who consume Michelle Obama's memoir are going to start a feminist revolution or something like that. The horizon of the knowledge and the level of the claims is different. I don't mean to be, you know, short-shrifting consumers. It's like a different epistemic enterprise. And it's one that I think as a rift happens a lot in Marxist cultural studies, but that I am on the side of the thinking of the poetics of social forms. I'm on the side of thinking about the conditions of production of cultural objects and less on the consumption side. If that starts to get an answer to you, I don't mean it to be, you know, a oh, everybody's a bad consumer. I definitely am more worried about the bad producers than the bad consumers. And more than even making that valuation of, oh, this is not good art or something, I'm just interested in trying to situate things like, why do we see these patterns and commonalities across these different modes at this, you know, historical conjuncture?
Part of your response to Lee's question reminds me a little bit of one of the main takeaways that at least I have from Adorno's thinking about aesthetics. And here I'm thinking about his essay in the culture industry more than aesthetic theory or other texts. But one of the jobs that the production of culture does is it reconciles the consumer to their lot in life as labor. It regiments our free time in ways that mimic the factory floor. It individualizes us in ways that industry has been separating and individualizing us. And it helps us adjust to what otherwise are conditions that would give rise to something like revolution or at least a strike. And so I hear you saying a little bit that we don't know how the consumer can take it, but at least one thing we can say is that these objects produce a situation that is the same situation that the consumer is facing in their everyday life, in their working life, and as labor.
When things are positioned for rapid uptake, or when they are positioned for personalized, algorithmically tailored mirroring, that reflects a situation where the consumers themselves don't have time to consume, right? Like they're working two jobs, they cannot afford the time to watch a movie, so they can only watch TikToks, or they don't feel that they have the luxury of the thicknesses of things that take a little while to get because they have to like get the message so that they can participate in the take culture around it so that they can have that opportunity for those bridges. Our opportunities for participating in culture have been dramatically attenuated by things like the Common Core curriculum and our attacks on education and attacks on the idea of public media. Their working conditions and their living conditions don't optimize, as it were, their consuming experience. So I think that a lot of the art that pretends to not be art, that is teaching us you've got it instantly, right? Like here's the message and the message is transparent and this is for you. And now go make your own. That is about habituating us back to that industrial context of always laboring in uncompensated and unproductive ways.
I don't want to be like Pavlov's dog here, but I do want to defend TikTok again at this moment because that just seems untrue to me. I think that we can see in TikTok right now, and again, I'm stipulating that you wrote this several years ago and TikTok is a very fast moving platform out there. But it does seem to me that what we're seeing in TikTok now is very similar to what Tufekci wrote about in Twitter and Tear Gas, that it actually is a site of comradeship. It is a site of political mobilization. And that doesn't always mean Marxist revolution. Sometimes that means a bunch of sixth graders figuring out how to prank their teacher. That's political organization. That's a way of saying this immediacy allows me to join with a group of people as a collective to do something collectively. And, you know, like kids don't prank your teachers, but at the same time, it doesn't surprise me if kids want to do this for all the reasons that you just said. They're in these Common Core public education classrooms and they're bored stiff. It seems pointless, you know, and they want to move fast and break things.
Well said, and surely true in all kinds of ways. I guess the question is, again, to go back to our question about strategy and tactics and who you're taking your logic from, what is the sustained kind of organization that might come out of these platforms or grammars? What is the capacity for actually ultimately wielding collective sovereignty and not just having spontaneous pranks?
So let me give you an example. Cyber sleuths. There are people solving crimes, literally solving crime, tracking down rapists. That's sustained collective political action.
I don't think that the deputizing of the public for the carceral state is a thing that I want to go down the road of championing the emancipatory apparatus for. I really don't. I mean, that's like next door.
No. I'm not thinking about next door. Most of these people are not considering themselves deputies. They're considering themselves victims advocates. That's a totally different thing.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I would want to look at some study of these.
Yeah. Anyway, I interrupted you. I'm sorry. You're making a completely fair point. I don't know why. I like this like weird tick to defend TikTok.
No, it's totally okay. And again, it's not a book against TikTok, right? It's
yeah, no,
just
I know.
Like, what are the grammars of it? And like, if one gets together politically for a specific moment through one of these technological opportunities. How can you sustain that moment? Mm-hmm. How can you have temporal duration when TikTok is a minute long, right? So there's a certain kind of incompatibility between some of what we might need to actually practice collective sovereignty in repetitive, boring, scaled, organized ways, and the logics of the temporal evanescence and the charismatic, spontaneous authenticity of these platforms.
Mm-hmm. I hope you don't think that I'm being unnecessarily difficult here. Like, I feel like I'm poking at things that I think an average listener who's not super familiar with Marxist theory would be asking.
No, I 100% appreciate that. And the whole point of writing a book that isn't a memoir is to try to get people to poke at things. I'm hazarding some frameworks and concepts and explanations. And if you want to argue with them, great.
Yeah. Right.
I think that's a good point in the sense that part of the issue with memoir and so on is it's ultimately unpokeable. Mm. You can't argue with that. So even though people can have a critical stance towards these things, they don't invite them. In their presentation of the immediacy of a reaction, you can't say to someone, you didn't react that way,
right?
Because they did.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a strange authority there that makes it difficult to engage in any critical discussion.
Yeah, I think that's something that I'm extremely concerned about in the anti-conceptual tendencies in the anti-theory chapter. Mm-hmm. Auto-theory is only one part of anti-theory. But if we have, yeah, the unpokeability and self-authorization of this is my experience. This is my human capital that is just shimmeringly intransitive and unconnected to anything else. And it's not here to make relation. It's not here to make ideas. It's not here to scale up. Then it's unimpeachable, but it's unengageable. And the only thing that anybody can do is mirror it, right? Like, okay, well, here's mine. Oh, what did your book inspire me to do? But go get my own memoir contract, right? It's not about higher order integrations. It's not about making knowledge. It's not about making teams or making unions or making relations. So this will be the time for Lee to say, okay, but surely somebody who reads memoir text might themselves not only write their memoir, but have meetings with other people about like, oh, let's be this group together. That's probably true. But one of the things that I'm just trying to track is the difference between how a critical autobiographical or memoir-esque text works in the 70s versus how it works now, when there are different conditions for producing knowledge in the university, different conditions for publishing, when there are different economic valuations of the personal mode.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should ask something of theory and knowledge workers and cultural workers that is about integrating, connecting, making frameworks, making categories, making ideas, and not just iterative succession of unremediable intensities. Again, because I think that logic is too close to the algorithmic situation of our data economy.
Did you know that Hotel Bart Podcast is more than just a podcast? We are a fully online cross-brand synergy platform of content creation. Actually, that's not true. Those words are meaningless. But you can follow us on the app formerly known as Twitter at Hotel Bar Podcast. There you can find the handles of all the co-hosts as well. You can follow us all or pick your favorite. If by the time you hear this, Elon Musk has burned down the servers to collect the insurance, you can also find us on Facebook or YouTube. Just look for Hotel Bar Sessions. Wherever you find us on social media, you can contact us with ideas, complaints, and questions. You can also email us anytime at hotelbarpodcast@gmail.com or visit our interactive page at hotelbarpodcast.com. No matter how you get in contact with us, we're always glad to hear from you.
So, Jason, the other thing about unpokeability, okay, so you've just named that. I love that word. It's great. But if we think about this unassailability or this unrelatability, just these shimmering, discrete particulars, if one tries to say, wait, that's not all there is, then the problem is that people think that you're trying to negate their experience or their testimony. And I've noticed some realm of reaction is like, oh, well, it's mean to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to say in the book that there are some limitations to this formation. These are vulnerable confessions or they're compelling portrayals. people don't take effort to contextualize this criticism from a woman necessarily, because they especially expect that I would propagate the same mode and not do mean things. I don't consider it mean to contextualize, to try to connect to other modes and to other conditions.
I think part of the question is, how do we think ourselves as situated in a historical moment while constantly trying to transform that moment? Like, I recognize some of myself in this description, especially some of your discussion of what people are trying to do with theory. There's this passage in your book when you say, in this way, auto theory must be seen as an efflux of a context in which theorists with fair labor conditions like tenure encounter their dire lack of peer audience, and theorists without fair labor conditions hustle for crossover appeal to eke out a living. And I guess I'm named in the first part of that.
I'm in the second.
And I feel like I'm constantly trying to think about what it means to write in a situation where you can't count on producing the same sort of audience. With the dismantling of humanities programs across the board and so on, you write a book about Spinoza and Marx that talks about Breaking Bad, which I did. And you try to find new ways to connect. And in some sense, I find myself named by that, but unlike some people who reacted to that passage or similar passages, I don't find myself really called out by it. I just am asking this question: how do you produce forms of mediation and reflection in an environment of immediacy? I mean, you can tell yourself, and oh, well, all the social media activity is oriented towards the book, and people read the book, they'll reflect and think. But I'm not sure if that's possible, if part of what's happening is there's a very immediate response to this thought about immediacy.
Yeah, I think that's a totally crucial question. It absolutely tortured me while I was writing the book. You know, it seems like it's a move you can't make to say, let's do more mediation. And it's a move you can't make when your profession has been systematically dismantled. So the people who have the opportunity to, in their workplace, engage with ideas like this are being winnowed as a body, mm-hmm. right? Who is it for if there have been already multiple generations of would-be intellectuals expelled from the profession in terms of any secure positions? Many of them are still in the profession in insecure positions. Are they out there wanting to consume ideas, wanting to be connected, but their working conditions make it so that, no, they're not going to read the book. They're just going to read somebody's Facebook rant and somebody else's sub rant or somebody's nasty tweet or whatever. And that's going to make them feel as if, oh, I got that book. And there's an authentic problem of they're teaching a 4-4 load at three different schools, and how do they have time to read things? And, oh, I read that mean grad student's tweet, and so now I know that I shouldn't spend my time with this. And we need criticism to filter and sieve for us because we don't have infinite time. I want people to argue with the book, but I would really like them to have read it before they're nasty about it on social media.
That's a tall order, Anna.
And can I just say for Dave, a 4-4 load is teaching four courses each semester over two semesters.
Right.
So 4-4 refers to a teaching load. Dave is my brother-in-law who is a listener. We have to explain inside baseball.
Hi, Dave. I didn't mean to be inside baseball. 4-4 would generally correspond to schools that are less research intensive. So faculty right. are spending more of their time teaching and less of their time reading and writing, even though those things should go together. I'm sorry, Dave. So how do you produce forms of mediation in an environment of immediacy? The thing I'm left with is I'm just going to try to formulate this category. I'm going to try to offer some examples. I'm going to try to explain it, offer some account of its cause. I'm going to try to offer counterexamples. There are exhortations in the book, and maybe it will provoke some things or poke some things for some people, but I don't have a lot of consolation that it's going to do anything. You know, like I finished writing this book before I spent an entire year bargaining my faculty union contract and helping with our faculty strike. And the work that I did writing the language in that contract, more people will have their lives affected by that writing than anything I'll ever do, no matter how well the book sells or doesn't. But that doesn't mean that I don't want to be equipped with or emboldened by an interpretation of the predicament of the style and the culture of immediacy when I recommend that people do unionize or that they do engage in these repetitive structures like the organizing chat. like the script that you need to have your talks over and over again, or to circle back to, sorry, that's corporate lingo, but to follow up over and over again on bringing your people in and making your connections. And then like doing all the work on how should this policy be phrased so that somebody's life is actually better in the workplace. That is mediating work. And the disdain for unions that we might often have on the left, and hopefully that's transforming a little bit recently, but is anathema to that repetitive work, that mediated thickening of those genres. So organize your workplace. That's where the book ends, with cultural workers who are doing that stuff. We won't get a better style until we have better working conditions. That's definitely true.
I could not possibly agree with you more on that. I suppose I would just say, though, that we also need the charismatic person on the soapbox giving me a one-minute speech.
Yeah. My union president is really compelling as a talker, and I get it. I get it. Slogans, you know, they're little mediations that hold things together that prompt movements. Mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter is such a powerful slogan. Mm-hmm. Or Medicare for All.
Me too.
Right.
Unfortunately, our bartender is giving us last call. He said we have to get out of here immediately. I want to give everybody a chance for last thoughts. Rick?
And I just want to thank you for spending time with us to actually, I think, engage in a bit of mediating through the question of immediacy. And I think we try here at Hotel Bar Sessions to bring that slower, reflective pace of mediation to people who otherwise wouldn't have the chance. So thank you very much for joining us and bringing us this topic. Jason, what about you?
You know, we didn't get to talk about this, but I'm wondering if some of the turn towards immediacy is an effect of the hyper meta things that came before. And if we're seeing a dialectic unfold, and maybe a third thing is going to emerge when people get tired of immediacy as instant gratification. And we don't know what that third thing is yet. It's not going to be meta. It's not going to be immediate, but it's going to be the synthesis of a sort. So look for that coming soon, hopefully.
I mean, on that synthesis note, I think one of the things that's funny in the book is, if we're no longer in postmodernism, when did it end? Or what are the things that are the same and what are the things that are different? There's all kinds of ways that immediacy is merely an intensification of postmodernism, but precisely on this rejection of the meta, rejection of the hyper, rejection of mediation, and instead of the waning of affect, we have a waxing of affect. There are all kinds of ways that we are, I think, decidedly in something that's not postmodernism. So will immediacy last as long as postmodernism? You know, how long are you going to be waiting for the synthesis? I don't know. The conditions of capitalist extremity or circulation intensity that set both the horizon for postmodernism and for immediacy, are those going to change anytime soon? I don't know. I definitely think that we're moving more towards slurry in the AI era. I mean, you know, we spent time thinking about TikTok, but AI is the other thing. The launch of ChatGPT happened after the book was finished. So what is it that we're moving toward in terms of just soup and diluted nonsense formats that we're immersed in and that don't have organizing ballast or don't help us make sense of the world? I'm not sure that something better than immediacy is coming. I love the synthesis, but I don't know.
Well, I want to echo Jason and Rick's thanks. You know, we don't often have guests on the podcast who are naming a moment, giving a name to the present. And you've really given us two to think about here, immediacy and too late capitalism. I think both of those are really helpful. I want to encourage everybody to go out and buy the book. Again, Immediacy or the Style of Too Late Capitalism. And yeah, feel free to tweet at us immediately and let us know what you think about it.
If I could say one more thing, I'm sorry, I meant to say this earlier, but I love that you guys do this. I love the idea of the conversation and the collaborative nature of the meaning making that goes on in a conversational podcast, in a hotel bar, like the luxurious sense of just sitting around having ideas together is so, so special. And it's super work for you guys, but it's really nice to have that model of podcasting out there. So thank you for doing it.
Well, you're welcome back. We'll save your stool for you. All right, everybody. I'll see you next time.
Take care. Bye.